We're in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, finishing our study of that. A very interesting chapter to me. Starting with verse 9, Ecclesiastes 8, verse 9. If you think about life for a moment, your life, our lives, there are a lot of mysteries in life. There are a lot of things that we can't explain in our world and in our experience. For Winston Churchill, it was the Russians in World War II. He considered them to be a mystery. They were perplexing to him. I was reading on that today, and they were unpredictable from his vantage point. They were illogical in their choices and their actions, and so all of that became very confusing to him. And there's a famous quote associated with that from Churchill. Of course, he and Spurgeon and others are known for their many quotes. Churchill said this about the Russian situation: "It is a riddle wrapped up in a mystery inside an enigma." Now think about that. That situation to him was a riddle wrapped up in a mystery put inside an enigma. Just a very poetic way of saying they were very confusing to him. Well, that's true about life in general. Like I said, there are many things that happen in our experience that we might say are riddles, you know, wrapped up in a mystery and shrouded inside an enigma. And whether it's trying to understand some very complex things about the universe, for example, trying to delve into it and explain and understand the world of electrons and protons and neutrons, you know, the atomic world, or whether it's just trying to understand simple mysteries, like how you can put three pairs of socks into a dryer. And when the cycle's done, there's only 2.5 pairs in there. You know, where does that sock go? It's a mystery. Our life consists of mysteries. Some of the greatest mysteries have to do with suffering, with disappointments, with trials. No doubt all of us here tonight have had mysteries of some kind that have invaded our lives. No doubt you have had things happen to you that have shaken you in some way, that have confused you, that have stunned you, we might say. When God leaves us with a mystery that isn't solved in a week or two, sometimes many people go through desperate struggles, fighting over the idea, is he good and fair like he's supposed to be? I mean, when a mystery has invaded your life and has stunned you, there can be that struggle believing whether he's good and fair. After all, we're supposed to trust him. And if we're going to trust God, he should only do things that are right. Correct? If we're going to trust him, he should not be doing mysterious things that confuse us. All of this relates actually to a theological term called theodicy. I don't know if you've ever heard that, but theodicy is a word that refers to the argument that is in defense of God's goodness, despite the presence of evil and wickedness in the world. Theodicy. We're surprised when things are mysterious. But why should we be, really? I mean, if God steps in and does things that are mysterious beyond our understanding, why should we be surprised at that? Why should that make us wonder whether or not he's good? Why should it make us wonder if we want to keep on believing and trusting? I mean, since when must everything that happens be easily or logically explained? Hold your place there in Ecclesiastes and turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. There's a passage here in 1 Corinthians 2, verses 6 to 8, that help bring us back to thinking soundly about all of this. 1 Corinthians 2, 6 and 8. "Yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, a wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away. But we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory." And you get the idea as you read this that there is a body of knowledge and wisdom that is from God that's definitely beyond man's understanding. Verse 8, "the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood. For if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." In other words, there's a lot about God that we might say is mysterious. There's a sense in which he operates in the realm of a very mysterious wisdom, a wisdom not like human logic, a wisdom not based on human knowledge. And if we forget that, if we forget his transcendence in that way, we are headed for trouble at some point. It really is wrong for us to think that we have to understand all the mysteries that are associated with our Heavenly Father. Only God has thoughts and ways that are beyond our ability to grasp. If you're in 1 Corinthians 2, I should have asked you to stay there just for a moment. If you left that, go back to it. There's verse 11 I should read. Familiar verse to it, to us. Talks about some of the things that only God knows. It says those things are known only by His Spirit. Why? Because the Spirit is God. He understands the things of God. 1 Corinthians 2:11. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of a man? In other words, a man can understand another man. A person can understand a person because we have similar human experiences. Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Why? Because they're divine thoughts. They're thoughts that Isaiah said in the book of Isaiah. We find that there are thoughts that God says are higher than our thoughts and different than our ways. Well, in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, starting in verse 10, though we're going to include verse 9 in it. We studied verse 9 last time, but it's kind of a hinge verse that propels us into the next section. So we'll look at it again. In this segment, starting at verse 9 and following, all the way through chapter 9, verse 1, it's a portion of his journal that talks about a couple of mysteries, and they're familiar mysteries to us. One is the mystery of the triumph of wickedness in this world. And the other is the mystery of the unfairness in consequences in this world. Let's look at that first mystery, the triumph of wickedness. Verse 9 and 10. All this I have seen and applied my mind to every deed that has been done under the sun, wherein a man has exercised authority over another man to his hurt. In other words, authority that hurts other people, oppresses other people. Verse 10, so then I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place, and they are soon forgotten in the city where they did their wickedness. This too is futility. What's he talking about here? In this section, Solomon is describing his indignation, his righteous indignation over how wicked people seem to get away with their wickedness. They seem to prosper. In verse 9, you've got the idea of wicked rulers, evil rulers who oppress other individuals who are under them. And there doesn't seem to be any repercussions in many of the cases of that throughout our history. And there's a bit of irony in the oppression there. In verse 9, the Hebrew is interesting. It says that a man has exercised authority over another man. The word man and man are the word Adam, A-D-A-M is how we would write that in English. We would pronounce it Adam. Adam got his name. Adam, the earth, the ground. Solomon is using these two terms like this, wherein a man, Adam, one person, rules Adam, another person. And he does it to his hurt. There is a sense of unity in the sinfulness of the human race there with Solomon using that term. But it's also pointing out the tragedy of what can happen under human government. Wicked rulers oppress other people and many times get away with it. But whether it's a wicked ruler who oppresses or whether it's another wicked person. He goes on to verse 10 to say that when they die, the funny thing, the ironic thing is when they die and they're eulogized at their funeral, they're eulogized in such a way that the wicked things they did seem to have been forgotten. Okay? When they die, only good things are said at the funeral. In verse 10, where you see, I've seen the wicked buried, that language there is to be interpreted kind of as a paraphrase. He's not literally meaning buried and put in the ground. It's a way of describing their funeral, the burial of someone, the funeral of someone. He's basically saying this. In such circumstances, I have observed the funeral of a wicked person. And the people who came to this place, that they came in and out of attending this funeral. And at this funeral, this wicked person was praised in the very city where he had been behaving in such a wicked manner. He says, that's absurd. I couldn't help but think of a line from Shakespeare there. I have very few things I remember that I had to memorize in high school. The poem Invictus, which is a terrible thing to still have on your mind after all these years. It's a very humanistic poem. But there's a line from Julius Caesar there, after Caesar was killed. He said, the good that men do lives after them. The bad is oft interred with the bones. He goes on to say, so let it be with Caesar. The good that they do lives after them. The bad is often buried with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. That's the way it is with wicked people. Doesn't matter what they did. You go to the funeral and, boy, they're made to sound like the greatest person that's ever lived. And to make it worse, verse 11, the government actually contributes to the problem by not punishing wicked people. Verse 11, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly. Therefore, the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. The government's supposed to punish wickedness. Here are these wicked people that have achieved success in life in spite of, or in some cases even because of, their oppression of others and their wickedness. But because wickedness is not dealt with the way the Bible would say it ought to be dealt with, then others are encouraged to eventually follow the path of the wicked because there's no consequences. In other words, injustice that reigns in the world, that's not stopped, seems to encourage people to choose evil over good even more because you can get away with it. So rather than a turning away from wrong, the individual intensifies his wrong. So truly and mysteriously, Solomon is really saying, those who traffic in injustice or unjust actions often get away scot-free, and they even increase their evil deeds. And so the mystery is, why doesn't God do something? Why does it keep going on? Wickedness, evil, oppression, unfairness. By the way, if you're talking to somebody, don't ever tell anyone that if they sin, they're going to suffer consequences for it. Don't say that if you mean this world, because it's not always true. That doesn't always happen in this world. True, in the life to come, you give an account, no doubt. But many, many times in our world, wickedness triumphs. Reality is that in this world, the wicked, even in spite of a notorious reputation, a wicked person often achieves prosperity. And when they come to the end of their earthly life, somehow all their life is made to appear honorable at their funeral. Isn't it amazing? Isn't it mysterious how some individuals can get away with cheating, with deception, with dishonor, with lying, and then go right on into more extreme acts of disobedience and dishonor, virtually untouched by the God of justice? Solomon just says it's a mystery. There's another mystery, and I want you to skip verses 12 and 13, because the second mystery is not found until verses 14 and 15. The second mystery is this, the fact of the unfairness of consequences. One is the triumph of wickedness, and the other mystery is the unfairness of consequences. The unfairness of consequences. Verse 14. There is futility which is done on the earth. That is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this too is futility. Solomon is very blunt with what he's saying here. Virtue is not always rewarded in this world. And the opposite, wickedness, sometimes is rewarded. This brings up God's providence, the workings of God in the world. Providence, God's working. Providence, we personify providence by treating providence as if providence itself is a person. But we know when we say that, that we mean God. But providence seems to treat some good men as though they were wicked. And providence seems to treat some wicked men as though they were good. There are examples like that in our world. Think about it for a second. Think about it in the Christian world. Great missionaries throughout church history. Why is it that a courageous, godly missionary is martyred rather than the brutal murderers who live there? Why is it that an entire family, a father, a mother, and some children can be going down the highway and be hit head on by a drunk driver and the family be all wiped out and the drunk driver what? Walk away, we say, without a scratch. Why is it that organized crime, the mafia, but organized crime, why is it they get rich on pornographic sites and drug abuse and prostitution and gambling, etc.? Why is it they make all that kind of millions and millions and millions of dollars when you and I at times are scarcely making ends meet as we're trying to live godly lives? You see, it's a mystery. It's a riddle wrapped up in a mystery inside an enigma. And since God doesn't ever seem to change it, some even argue that God is participating in the injustice because he could do something and he doesn't. Wickedness goes unpunished, verse 14. So God participates in the injustice. Those are two perplexing mysteries about our world. We can't deny them. They're true. But though those are perplexing mysteries, the good news is God's people don't have to live in a state of confusion and anxiety and turmoil. Now back to 12 and 13. This is a sandwich. Okay, the meat's kind of in the middle of those two slices of bread. Verses 12 to 13, we actually find an answer to all this. Although a sinner does evil 100 times, it may lengthen his life. Still, I know that it will be well for those who fear God and fear him openly. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. In the first part here, verse 12, you have this picture who's the personification, this individual who's the picture, the personification of enjoyment and pleasure in life. He's able to enjoy life even though there is such a mystery in life about wickedness and evil and consequences and unfairness and injustice. He enjoys life. I mean, think of the alternative. The alternative is becoming bitter. It's becoming cynical. It's questioning God. It's being never at peace. It's becoming neurotic in the pursuit of trying to find the answers to all these things and these mysteries. All the whys of life. That is a choice as well. Verse 12 is a person who did not make that choice. I'll read it again. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. God gives us the ability to live differently. He gives us the ability to accept and embrace reality, even though, as human beings, we're at a loss to try to explain things. There is no way to find merriment or joy in life, any genuine relief apart from the truth of these words that we find in verse 12. He's saying that even though sin goes on 100 times over even than what it is now, even though a life may be lengthened due to, in spite of a sinful lifestyle, you know, in spite of their lifestyle, they still live long. Even though that's true, or as Job said, even though he slay me, I will hope in him. In other words, I am without answers, yet I still believe in him. You see, people are wrongly encouraged in their evil deeds by the abuse of power and abuse of position by those in authority. They're encouraged by the wicked receiving honorable burials. They're encouraged by the delays being allowed in the administration of justice that encourages evil, yet Though that's true, it will be well for those who fear God. And the opposite is true, ultimately, for those who don't fear God. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 13. It will not be well for the evil man. He will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. This is talking about the ultimate and eternal perspective about this wicked man. There are those who fear God and those who don't. In fact, the word fear occurs three times here in these two verses. That's Solomon's way of emphasizing that there are those who truly and genuinely and habitually fear God, and there are those who don't. You and I don't always know the difference now, but God does. It's interesting. In Malachi chapter 3, verse 18, the prophet talked about this just a little bit. It says this in Malachi 3:18, "So you will again distinguish between the righteous and the wicked, between one who serves God and one who does not serve him." He's prophesying of a day when that distinction will be made. There will be a day when discernment will be clear, the difference between those who fear God and those who refuse to fear him, because in that day, a most exacting justice is going to be meted out. We have to go back to that. That even though the wicked may appear to be getting away with murder, as verse 12 says, 100 times, with that kind of sinning, they will eventually and finally experience judgment by the living God. We call it the just deserts. The just deserts of the wicked right now seem, Solomon says, to often fall on the righteous person, the God-fearer, while the rewards that are supposed to go to the righteous appear to drop into the lap of the wicked. And you can understand that problem only by the wisdom that's found in the fear of God. The plan of God, the ability to enjoy life as offered by God to everyone who trusts Him. We forget that Scripture promises our lives now will be filled with suffering. There is a kingdom to come in the future where there will be reward and there will be glory. And we've got too many trying to bring the glory of the future into the present time. When the Bible has clearly said, now's the time for suffering. It's really amazing that Solomon affirms faith in God here. And he does it without presenting any kind of evidence. He just says, I know this to be true. This is faith. This is a word of faith in the face of contradictory evidence, actually. He does not rationalize the situation. He does not try to explain or defend his belief in divine justice. And the fact that he doesn't, I think, even more strikingly characterizes his affirmation as an act of faith. We must not forget the basic principle of salvation. And it's also a basic principle of how we are to live as Christians. It's this phrase in Scripture, "The just shall walk by faith." We come to Christ in faith, and we are justified. And the just shall walk by faith. Another basic thought on this subject of faith is Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Solomon is living out that right here. Verse 12. If you look at the evidence, the things seen, you could come to a different conclusion. The eye of faith sees something different. So let's just be honest here for a moment. Neither you nor I can completely explain the mysteries or grasp the intricacies of God's plan in history. We don't know when it's going to reach its goal. We don't know how or when God's going to deal with wrong. We just know this, He will. We know God is going to keep His word. So until then, what do? We enjoy life, living for the Lord. We eat, we drink, we find happiness, we find contentment in our lives. Even though evil triumphs, even though there are unfair consequences happening all around us, we trust God to see us through. We know He's working it out, and we can live in the midst of all this mystery, content in the Lord. And we sometimes forget this. We sometimes forget that we trust God to see us through. We sometimes forget that He's working everything out. And that's when we struggle, when we forget it. That's when we stop eating and drinking and enjoying life. That's when we stop sleeping because of worry and anxiety. That's when we start getting caught up in thinking that we've got to fix things. The church has to fix things. The government has to fix everything. We put our eggs in this basket that somehow, if we all do enough good, we will turn the tide on all this. Solomon didn't write this last week. He wrote this a long time ago. It has not changed. It will never change. We have to constantly be reminded that this is the reality of the existence in this world. Scripture told us it would be this way. The millennial kingdom is something totally different. On this idea of being reminded of this, I found this poem called "Tell Me Again, Lord, I Forget." I just like the title of it. By Ruth Calkin. She writes this: "Lord, I'm drowning in a sea of perplexity. Waves of confusion crash over me. I'm too weak to shout for help. So, Lord, either quiet the waves or lift me above them. It's too late to learn how to swim." It's a great expression that I can't fix everything. I've had days when I have felt like that, certainly. Solomon is recognizing it in a very honest way, that this is the world we live in. Well, from the consideration of the injustice, then, it goes on, the mysteries, we find some conclusions that he kind of wraps up with, starting in verse 15. Here's his conclusions. We've looked at the sandwich with the meat of the answer that's in the middle, but there's some conclusions that flow out of it, verse 15. One conclusion is this: while we're here, people should, as God's people, we should enjoy the good things life does offer that God gives us, and not waste ourselves over being vexed with the problems of evil in the world. I mean, you have a choice. You can lose sleep. You can let that control you. Or you can enjoy the good things life does offer that God has given, and not spend yourselves, not waste yourselves in vexation over the problem of evil. 8:15. "So, I commended pleasure. For there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and to drink and to be merry. And this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life, which God has given him under the sun." Now, don't misinterpret Solomon here. He's not advocating some hedonistic lifestyle, or even some hedonistic indifference to suffering in the world. That's not the point. As people of God, we have soft hearts toward those who are being mistreated and those who are suffering. And we certainly want to minister to those individuals. But he does counsel that we come to terms with the limits of our abilities. We have a limit in our abilities to explain things, much less eliminate unjust suffering. Unending turmoil and vexation. That's just a good word. Unending vexation over this problem, Solomon says, is pointless. How refreshing, then, this capacity, this contented capacity that God gives to enjoy the gifts that He gives, this loving, all-wise God, to enjoy the gifts that He gives to those who have first sought Him and His righteousness in their lives. God's gift of enjoyment is to be preferred over all the prosperity of the wicked, over all the things that they may accumulate, over all those things for which they're so tempted to act so wickedly to get them. God's gift of enjoyment is something far better than that. Contentment and peace in life, even though we're surrounded by mysteries, always have been, always will be. You see, we can't fix all the evil. We can be salt and light in the realm God puts us in. And we can seek to see the gospel change individuals' lives. And that's what we're to be about. We're called to that. And to live for that. But we can't fix all the evil in the world. If we think we can, you'll not sleep at night. You'll live in turmoil. You'll miss what God is saying all along you ought to be doing. And that's enjoying life. Enjoy it. I mean, let's apply this to our own lives and our situations. Forget the problems of the world. Just say just some problems in your own life. Some of your situation, your circumstance, whatever it might be. We may try to fix a particular situation that we're in. Sometimes it has to do with another person. Sometimes it has to do with our family. Sometimes it has to do with finances. There's a lot of things in our own lives. It's not just the wickedness across the world. It's the challenging situation of our own life. We can do everything we know to do to fix that. And many, many times we'll still come to the same conclusion that we can't change things. We're limited. I think it's time to admit things like this. I have no power to change every situation that exists in the world, much in my own life, much less the world. It's coming to the conclusion where you pray like this: Lord, you know what's best for me. And so while you work out your plan, I eat and I drink and I worship you and I serve you. I will find my joy in you. This is what you've given me throughout the days of my life in the midst of this toiling world we live in. This is what you've given to me under the sun. I'm going to walk in it. I'm going to live in it. That explains how a Christian can have joy in the midst of wild and crazy, mysterious circumstances. There's kind of a second conclusion here, verse 16 and 17. There's a sense in which God has deliberately made life unpredictable. He's deliberately made it to be mysterious, or sovereignly allows it to be mysterious. Ultimately, it's God's sovereign control. In order to thwart human efforts to master and control everything. 16 and 17. When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on the earth, even though one should never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, I know, I found it, I know the answers, Solomon says, no, he can't discover it. Solomon discovered something. It's the nature of God's activity. He says there in these verses, I saw the work of God. Verse 17. And he's admitting, I saw it and I cannot comprehend it. Every endeavor of wisdom to find the key by which you can master life and control the future, every single effort of it is bound to fail. I mean, we saw this in earlier in chapter 8, verse 7. If no one knows what will happen, who can tell him when it will happen? That's a statement about the future. We see this to be true with our inability to predict the future. I mean, if we could know with certainty what is going to always bring prosperity, always bring long life, then we're in a place where we're controlling life and we're controlling God. So what does God do in his providence? He allows many things, he creates many things to exist even, that we will never solve. We'll never be him. Regardless of how much wisdom we attain, education we attain, there always will be some insoluble mysteries about his providence. People can search for the answers, but they will discover that they'll be shut out from them. Kind of like the man who went on the same quest for wisdom in Job chapter 28. In Job 28:13, it says something like this: man does not know its value, meaning wisdom. He doesn't know the value of it or the way to get it. Nor is it found in the land of living. That's 28:13 of Job. In 28:23, later on, he says, God understands its way. He knows its place. He knows full wisdom. He knows the big picture. He defines what reality is because he sees the whole picture. We don't. He understands wisdom, its way, and its place. Later on, Job chapter 28, verse 28. And to man, God said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. To depart from evil is understanding. That's what we need to know. No wonder that even those who call themselves wise or people that the world calls wise cannot know everything that goes under the sun. Goes on. You know, to the degree that God reveals his plan to believers, to that degree only we're able to understand things. What he reveals to us in his word, that's what we can understand. But there's still mystery left. And only God knows it entirely. We are mortals. We only know in part. We have to admit then we're human. Okay, we're not God. Sometimes people get too impressed with themselves that they forget that they're finite and fallible. There are many things we won't figure out. God won't let us. There will always be diseases that we can't cure. Always. There will always be mysteries we can't solve. And it ought to keep us humble. And we ought to be trying with God's power not to let it affect our faith. What it ought to do, in fact, is that it would deepen our faith in God when we come to realize that we can't control him. It deepens my faith in him. There's another conclusion here, chapter 9, verse 1. And the conclusion is this: God is showing us that all things are in his hands. Everything is in his hands. Chapter 9, verse 1. For I have taken all this to my heart and explained it that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Man does not know whether it will be love or hatred that he'll get in life. Anything awaits him. So what Solomon believes is that we as God's people have to accept with joy what he brings our way in his good providence, whatever it is. And what we experience in his providence may be mysteries. It may be struggles. It may be difficulties. Even if we're seeking to be godly all along the way. He says, love or hatred. What do those words refer to? They refer respectively to the divine favor or disfavor. We don't know. In the sense of the things that will happen in life. You know, how the world looks at that. That's how they define them. But I do talk to people, and there are many, that think that they're winning God's approval and his blessings by doing all the right things. And the reality is, even right living may not result in visible blessing. I've talked with some along the way who expected something different than that. And I'll hear it in the words they tell me when they describe, I'm reading the word, I'm praying, I'm having my quiet time, I'm serving, I'm giving, I'm operating my business with integrity, so God's going to make everything work out, right? He's going to make my business successful, right? Not necessarily. It doesn't always work out. They're suffering. Good people suffer. People who operate in business with integrity lose their businesses sometimes. I do understand that part of the problem is that we end up defining God's blessings the wrong way. See? We tend to define blessings only externally. That if I live with integrity in my business will always prosper. And there are plenty of examples of people who have operated with integrity. And plenty of people have taken advantage of them and they go out of business. You see, God's blessings sometimes are different, far different than that. It's soul prosperity that absolutely is guaranteed regardless of the circumstance. The blessings of God where there's contentment and joy and the clear conscience, that right there is worth more money than people have. A clear conscience before the Lord. That's the blessing of God. If I've lived my life with integrity because it was the right thing to do and my business went out of business anyway, I can still hear God say someday, well done, good and faithful businessman. What a comforting thought in chapter 9, verse 1, that our deeds are in the hand of God. Do you know the Apostle Paul said the same thing later on in 2 Timothy 2, verse 19? The first part of 2 Timothy 2:19, Paul says, "Nevertheless, the firm foundation of God stands, having this seal, the Lord knows those who are His." Even if we're struggling and suffering, even if we're wrapped up in one of these riddles that's wrapped in a mystery that's inside an enigma, the Lord knows those who are His. You're not hidden from His sight. And ultimately, in the fear of the Lord, in knowing Him, being right with Him in my heart, and seeing the world through His eyes instead of human logic, this is where our search for identity ends. This is where our search for meaning in life ends. This is where an explanation of the presence of evil and injustice and inequalities in life ends. It ends in the fact that God is on the throne. He's sitting at the helm of everything. He is ruling and overruling things for His glory and the good of His people. And consequently, His people, their works and their very lives are protected and governed by the God who is over all. We are safe in His hands. Like I said, there's always going to be some mysteries. No one can tell just by God's treatment of a particular individual whether the object of God's love or hatred. You can't tell visibly, necessarily, externally. In fact, we've already seen this warning from Solomon about wealth in chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. We saw it in chapter 7, verses 1 to 15. That adversity, that on one hand, prosperity is not always necessarily a good thing. We saw that. And on the other hand, we saw that adversity and affliction are not always bad things. God's approval or disapproval of us cannot always be read from all this that's before us. He ends that phrase by saying, anything awaits Him. Whatever's before us, whatever awaits us. Things are not what they seem to be. Things are not what they seem to other people to be about us. That's always, you always get that illustration from Job's counselor, his three so-called friends. They took the bare facts of his suffering, the evidence, and they incorrectly concluded Job has sinned grievously. Otherwise, he would not be suffering like he is. We cannot conclude that God hates those to whom He sends adversity or He loves those to whom He sends prosperity. You can't go by that. If believers are to walk by faith, there are going to be times when outward appearances and facts will defy the explanation for the moment. And it's certainly cruel to add to somebody's burden who is suffering to suggest, well, you definitely are not the object of God's favor here because you're struggling. That's very narrow-minded reasoning. And that suggests that all suffering is a result of personal sin. And you can find all these examples in history, biblical history, of suffering that had amazing purposes. Suffering that's educational, that teaches people about the ways of God and the truth about this world and the truth about sin and consequences. There's suffering that ends up being revelational. Think about Hosea and his suffering with his wife. I mean, there was revelational truth taking place through that suffering experience that he had with his wife, because what was going on there was teaching and revealing truth about Hosea and others' own spiritual adultery when he lost his own wife in physical adultery, physical harlotries. It was revealing a truth about the nation, even about Hosea. There's some suffering in the Bible that was sacrificial. The Lord, He suffered as a sacrifice because of the sin of others. Theodicy. The argument of God's goodness even in the presence of evil. Solomon, the preacher here, has taken that in an amazing direction to me. That the apparent injustice of the world is proof, actually, of the sovereignty of God. It's not something that makes us question the sovereignty of God. It is proof that He is in control. That no one, even by their righteous living, can control Him. No one. Everything's in God's hands. Well, if with God's help we apply all this and live it out in our daily experience, we as a result will be actually a mystery ourselves. Think about it. Live this way. Contented in the midst of evil around you. You know, addressing evil. Solving things that can't be solved. Bringing truth to bear on situations and going home and sleeping at night. You'll be a mystery. See, you'll be a mystery to others. Having pleasure and enjoyment in this world, in this life, even in the midst of the vexation of evil, the problem of evil, and all the unfairness of the world, that's a very unusual thing to see. That's going to create all kinds of interest in how you think. What kind of person are you? It's doors for the gospel, see. Opportunities for sharing, as Peter says, for the giving the reason for the hope that's within us. So through all the mystery, the bottom line is we are to trust. We're to trust in the Lord. We're to depend on His Word. And we do that, and we become a mystery to the world. Let's pray.